Hello, this is Earl Fontenelle. This is the Schwepp, the Secret History of Western Esotericism podcast, episode 9 in our series on reincarnation in the West, coming back for more. And today we're delighted to welcome back for more Joel Calvis-Maki, a man who works on the really, really interesting sort of marginal side of religion, magic, science, knowledge in the Eastern Mediterranean in late antiquity and into the first millennium. Joel, thank you so much for coming back on the Schwepp.
What a pleasure. Good to see you.
Likewise. We've just talked about Origen with Jonathan Young, and the conclusion about Origen was that although people like Jerome, who took a strong anti-Origen turn in his era, accused him, among other heresies, of supporting this suspicious Platonist doctrine of transmigration of souls, he maybe didn't support it, or maybe he did. It's not really 100% clear from his surviving works. But what we have later is this specter of Originism. And this is where things get really, really complex. There's a whole series of important authors, notably Didymus the Blind and Evagrius of Pontus, who clearly are influenced by Origen, but also clearly are original thinkers in their own right. They're Christians speculating about theology and so on. We also have this tradition among communities, notably Syriac monastic communities, of reading Origen, reading Didymus, reading Evagrius, and perhaps doing some speculating of their own right up to the 6th century. And in the 6th century, we're going to run into Justinian, who wants to put the kibosh on all this kind of nonsense. So I thought the first thing I'd like to talk to you about is, as someone who has helped to edit and translate the surviving works of Evagrius for the OUP volume that came out a few years ago, which is a great resource for people, what do we find in Evagrius that might make us think that he did have a teaching that is somehow to do with the transmigration of souls?
Yeah, we'll wisely pass over Didymus for now, mainly because is not well studied, and his corpus is probably in worse shape than Evagrius's. But for Evagrius, the question of the transfer of bodies, transfer of souls, is bound up in the Cephalaia Gnostica, the work that's probably the most controversial of Evagrius's, along with the so-called letter to Melania. And we have only about 25% of the Cephalaia Gnostica in its original Greek. The rest of it survives in two Syriac translations. One, termed S1, is the common version, but it really gets rid of large swaths of metaphysical speculation that are woven throughout the text. The version that we call S2 is known through only one Syriac manuscript, and it comports very well with the Greek that we have. In fact, it almost always agrees with the Greek fragments against S1 when there's a difference. But it does not try to remove or change any of the metaphysical speculations. It's all right there. And when we read about something that looks like reincarnation or transmigration of souls or change of bodies, we're doing it through a Syriac translation and a Syriac intermediary. And it is a Syriac intermediary that's translating a puzzling text. In the Cephalaia Gnostica, Evagrius is elusive and allusive and wants the reader to work hard piecing this material together. Before we get into the transfer of bodies, there's a couple of things that those passages were referred to that we need as a kind of foundation. One is pertaining to the physics of bodies. Angels, demons, and humans, they all have different compositions. And this is most famously explained in Cephalaia Gnostica 1:68, where he says, according to our translation of the S2 version, in the angels, there is a predominance of mind and fire. In humans, of desire and earth. And in demons, of anger and air. Those who are third approach those in the middle through the nostrils, as they say, but the first approach the second by the mouth.
Well, that's clear.
There's a lot to be said about this particular kephaleon, but the one I want to highlight is the predominance of an element in each of the three groups. So angels have fiery body, a predominance of fire. Humans have a predominance of earth, and demons have a predominance of air. Water is not in this mix as the fourth element. And there are other parts of the physics that are explained in the Kephaleonastica that would take us too far afield. What I want to note here, though, is that there is some kind of intersection in these three worlds, but they're also very different from each other, and they require a new theory of sense perception that Evagrius does not really unpack as we would like. The second thing that needs to be understood before we get into the question of transfer of bodies is the issue of multiple worlds, which Evagrius repeatedly discusses, that there are many worlds. So in 265, he says, from those who have attained to the perfect fullness of evil, it is possible for us to understand the multitude of worlds that have come to be. Indeed, it is not possible for us suddenly to be perfected in ignorance, because neither is it possible for us suddenly to be perfected in knowledge. In 269, just a few Kephaleon later, he says, according to the S2 translation, the Holy Spirit has made known to us not the first distinction of the logikoi and the coming to be of bodies, but rather it has revealed to us the present distinction among the logikoi and the transfer of bodies. So that's alluding to what we're going to be talking about in a bit, the transfer of bodies. When I say logikoi, that's a Greek transliteration of rational beings, which for Evagrius is the thing he's most interested in. He's not interested much in animals. So non-rational.
So this is going to be angels, humans, and daimones.
Correct.
Right?
That's right. Hmm. In 273, he says, just as the one who by his logos has revealed to us the matters of the world to come, so he has not told us about the coming to be of bodies and the bodiless. In the way that he has made known the coming to be of this world, he has not taught the passing of bodies and the bodiless, but he has told of their distinction and their transfer. The very next Kephaleon, who has known the first distinction, and who has seen the coming to be of bodies, or these different worlds from which some of the holy powers have been nourished and have ruled over a blessed kingdom? And in the very next one, as much as the judge has judged those to be judged, so also he made worlds. And he who knows the number of judgments knows also the number of worlds. Successive worlds, successive judgments, are they coterminous? We don't get that explanation. We are left to our fertile imaginations. We were in a seminar led by Evagrius, he might unpack that for us, but this is what we have. We know there are multiple worlds, multiple judgments, and some kind of transfer of bodies, which he then goes on in a couple items later. In 277, the last judgment does not make manifest the transfer of bodies. Rather, it makes known their annulment. That is, you've got some sort of transfer of bodies up until the final judgment, but at the last judgment, bodies are annulled. They're removed altogether, which is a departure from what we can reconstitute of Origen's doctrine.
Yeah, it's a departure from Paul.
Right? yes.
Or at least how Paul is normally understood.
That's right.
Like, we're going to have the spiritual body, and that's going to be the end of it. That's like our final place, is the spiritual body, eternal, hanging out with God in some way.
Yeah. Let me give you,
he's like, no.
Yeah, I know it. And that will show up. Before we get there though, we're still interested in this question of changes of bodies. So let me give you a few more. At 285, if the living are receptacles of increase and decrease, then they are the opposite of the dead. For it's clear that they are receiving these things. And if this is so, there will be various bodies, and worlds suitable for them will be created. At 287, two Cephalia later, he says, the movement of bodies is in time, but the transfer of the bodiless is timeless. And then that concludes a long run in century two of rumination on multiple worlds. But he revisits it in century four. At 489, he says, who will tell of the grace of God, and who will investigate the reasons of providence and how Christ guides rational nature by means of varied worlds toward union with the holy unity, which is probably Henad. 581, the next century, he says, when the mind will receive essential knowledge, then it will be called God, because it will also be able to fashion various worlds. So in the world to come, those who are perfected will be able to create their own worlds. Now, I think we can talk about some transfer of bodies. Now that we understand that, we understand that there is at least something about worlds and bodies that are interconnected somehow. And there's probably some physics behind this. In century three, we get a series of Cephalia dealing with changes of bodies or something like that. Let's dive in. 320, he says, the change of organa is the passage from bodies to bodies, according to the degree of the ranks of those who are joined to them. What this means, I don't know, but bodies to bodies, some kind of passage. At 348, we actually have a Greek fragment supporting it, so I'll read that. In fact, this is a pair with 350, so it's best to take this as a pair. This is one of the structural features of the Cephalia Gnostica. There will be sets of two, three, or four Cephalia that form a unit, but they're interspersed with other Cephalia between them. So we'll just bring these together for the sake of discussion. 348 and 350 in Greek. The judgment of the just is the transition from the practicing body to an angelic one. The change of the wicked is the transposition from a practicing body to darkened and gloomy bodies. Now, that's from Hiscolion the Psalms, and our experience in translating the Cephalia Gnostica is that he would write Hiscolia, and he would draw from them for the Cephalia Gnostica, but he would take liberty to adjust wording. So we don't know if this is actually what he wrote in the Cephalia Gnostica, but it's very interesting in its own right that he would put that in the Scolia. In the KG, the translation of S2 reads, the change of the just is the passage from practicing and seeing bodies to seeing or better seeing bodies. The change of sinners is the passage from practicing or demonic bodies to those that are even heavier and darker. And then the 351, of all the changes that happen before the world to come, some are yoked to excellent bodies and some to evil bodies. But those changes that will happen after the world to come will yoke all to knowing instruments.
So it seems like the organa that are being referred to, the instruments, right? There's something like an essential rational being separate from a body, but it can take on different instruments. The bodies are, this is the sort of like Alcibiades of Plato, not really by Plato probably, notion of the soul using the body as an instrument, right? Maybe lying behind this. So the bodies are instruments. Maybe the sensory organs are instruments, something like that.
That's normally what what organa means in most contexts is they are sense perceptive faculties.
Now, taking all that together, I'm trying to see if I can make sense of it in a what would eventually become orthodox eschatological framework, right? So you're born, maybe your soul pre-exists, maybe it doesn't, who cares about that? The point is you live and then you die. Once you've died, your soul is going to be somehow idling or something until the final resurrection. Everyone gets resurrected, judged, and you get a spiritual body, which is somehow your body, but presumably perfect and no longer subject to corruption and this sort of thing. And that body is then going to go on to be eternally rewarded or eternally punished, as the case may be. That's an eventual synthesis of a lot more debate that's going to go on throughout the first millennium and beyond. But can these statements from Evagrius be sort of fit into that? It doesn't seem like they can, really.
No, I don't think it's easily reconcilable. It's certainly covering the same territory. And it's interesting you should bring up the notion of the place where you're awaiting that final judgment, the area that we sometimes refer to as Hades or the world of the dead, most famously summarized in Christ's parable of Lazarus and the rich man, which was a very important passage for Evagrius. He wrote several things about this, or he actually wrote the same idea in multiple formats about it. But for him, the story of the rich man and Lazarus is really interesting for what the rich man does. He sees in the rich man something very admirable, that he is on the wrong side of the stick, so to speak. Nevertheless, he has pity on his brothers and his relatives. And for Evagrius, he sees that as virtue and a sign that seeds of virtue are permanent, even in a place such as the bad side of Hades. And I think there's a connection there with the succession of multiple worlds. To be irresponsible in my speculation, you might hypothesize that somebody like the rich man would be judged and given an opportunity to exercise virtue in a different body. What kind of body? I don't know. Did he deserve to be punted down to the demons? I don't know. Another human body? I don't know. Maybe there's a completely alternate universe in which we don't have demons, angels, and humans, but something else altogether.
Yeah. Let's talk about universes for a second, because the word in Greek that you've been translating as world, whatever the Syriac is, this is going to be cosmos, right?
Probably aeon.
Aeon, really? Okay, interesting.
I think so, yeah. For most of these, we don't have extant Greek, but there isn't much about cosmos in... It's not a word that Evagrius really comes to. It's for him, it's aeon. Aeon is.
Right. So that, I mean, translating that as world doesn't really do it justice, right? This is, it's a concept that has to do with time, for sure, often. But it is the concept, I mean, maybe this is significant, maybe it isn't, but it is the go-to concept among so-called Gnostic metaphysicians who are talking about kind of realms of reality in the story of emanation from the first god, the great invisible spirit, whoever he or she or it might be. There are often a bunch of aiones, right? Which are sort of realms of existence, parallel dimensions, to put it in modern terms, something like that. So if that's what Evagrius is talking about,
I'm just checking right now, and alame is the word. So, and actually, we do have Greek fragments where cosmos is attested.
Okay.
That said, we don't know if these are cosmoi or aeones.
Right. Interesting. Anyway, there's some kind of world, but we're not, I think, called upon to imagine alternate Earths or anything like that. It's much more just like a state of being in which a certain body, like we know that there are bodies in a lot of those passages you just mentioned, like there are bodies that are appropriate to a given world, a given type of world, right?
Yeah.
And the creator, who in the first instance is of course the one, but seemingly once the final judgment happens, there will be other co-creators maybe getting involved. But setting that aside, the creator created different realms or worlds appropriate to the different bodies, the different types of bodies. So there's, I guess at minimum, an angelic realm or realms. At minimum, there's our cosmos with humans walking around in bodies. And then there's also going to be some kind of demonic body realm, like aerial realm. I mean, one could go with a naive cosmology and say, well, the aerial demons are above us in a sort of air sphere around the earth. That's their world. This is what a lot of kind of ideas about demons, daimones in late antiquity seem to indicate. Like, yeah, the daimones actually live in the air and the air is above us and, you know, that's their realm. But setting that aside, presumably this is something like what he's talking about, right? Except he doesn't give us a number of realms, and maybe we're talking about some kind of truly vast universal model where there are like countless realms, right?
It could be, or it could be simple, like just the three worlds that okay, we've already mentioned. That, to bring it back to the first Cephalion that I read, we see that somehow there's some kind of interaction between the demonic world and ours via the nose. We can smell the demons.
Right.
And us and the angels through the mouth. Do we taste angels? I don't know. We speak angels.
Or they speak to us.
They speak to us, but somehow there's a the organon that by which we have access to the angelic world is our oral organon.
That is interesting. Lick the angel and know.
I don't see that. I haven't seen that fragment yet. Yeah. So.
So
hold that thought.
So thank you, first of all, very much for laying out some of this beautiful, intriguing, extremely vexing, intentionally so, Christian material from Evagrius of Pontus. Now, as you say, he's broken from origin. He's saying there is a disembodied state. There is a state when you become minds, that must certainly be translating nous, nois, and what was it? It was minds and something.
Oh, well, minds is probably sufficient.
Yeah, anyway.
This is how we, with the annulment of bodies.
Yeah, but I mean also not even having a soul anymore, being like just beyond this whole human state entirely, right?
Because the soul represents a fallen nous, right?
Yeah.
The nous, the mind, got chilled and refrigerated and hence got the name soul. It's a thickened mind. So to restore that, you have to wind your way back up, get rid of the body, get rid of the soul. Until we have in one of Evagrius's favorite phrases is naked mind.
Which is beautiful and a powerful image. Powerful image. I mean, I don't quite understand what Origen is trying to say about the soul. Well, I guess the soul always needing a body is fine, as long as you can have, because he does seem to have disembodied nois at the dawn of everything, that in the process of getting thickened and falling away from God create this whole drama we're in now. So maybe the key is to say, yes, a soul always has to have a body by nature, but a human being doesn't always have to be a soul. You can get beyond that, right? Which is actually a very Christian approach. Like soul, the devaluation of soul as opposed to pneuma, as opposed to spirit, is part and parcel of any Christian Platonism, any Christian attempt to take on Platonic ideas. There's always that kind of shift in the valuation of psyche from being like the top thing to something that's slightly not, you know, not as supreme. But let me throw another model at you. Clement of Alexandria, the great early church writer of the second century sometime, has a theory that, like Evagrius, is intentionally expressed with lots of circumlocution and not just laying it out as a doctrine, but can be convincingly reconstructed and has been recently, again, by Sami Yli Karyanma in a monograph, that the process of return to God works out through cyclical angelification, so that the angels in the level above humans are trying to teach them and bring them toward God and persuade them toward being virtuous and good. And if they do their job right, the human will then, after death, go on to become an angel of that rank. That angel that succeeded in seducing you toward God will then be promoted. And so there's this kind of constant process of promotion going on. Now, he doesn't go so much into the falling away from God, but that is part of his system as well. He doesn't really get into the details on that, but presumably there's a kind of demonification process that can happen as well, one might assume. Maybe he does get into that in some place and I'm just not aware of it. But anyway, let's just talk about because Clement is also known as a universalist, it seems to be the case that all rational beings are eventually moving toward God to some kind of unstated final outcome of just nearness to God, assimilation to the divine, right? Then in Origen, we have much less laid out. He's either cagier about this stuff, or the works where he talked about it, maybe his Stromates, which is lost, got into this more, but it doesn't survive. Everything we know about Origen, though, does seem to imply universalism. Or at least a lot of people thought he was a universalist. And he does think that we were originally nois, that through some kind of process of fall, entered into human bodies. And here we have Evagrius. Now, like, if I'm trying to put a system together that makes sense of all these passages from Evagrius, it seems something like Clement fits much more naturally than the Orthodox account of human life followed by either eternal reward or eternal punishment, because it takes account of the transfer of bodies. You're just transferring into angelic bodies or demonic bodies, as the case may be, depending on your the fruits of your labor here on earth. There are realms for these bodies, so there's a kind of place for them to do their thing. It seems like something along a Clementine lines here would be a perfect fit.
Mm-hmm.
Discuss.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think so. And I think there is as much sympathy in Evagrius' thought with Clement as with Origen. So some of these elusive passages that we've read, I think, presume of the reader that they are acquainted with these other authors as well. So yeah, it's part of the same world building enterprise, so to speak.
Mm.
I think that Evagrius takes some of this enough for granted that he does not have to say explicitly that demons can become humans and humans can become angels, because it seems to have been explicitly said in that earlier literature. There are a series of excerpts from the Periarchon in the letter of Justinian to the Patriarch Menas that are famous. Two of them, extract 12 and extract 13, say basically that humans may be promoted to angelic ranks and worse powers may be promoted to humans. So I look at the Kephalaia Gnostica as a kind of thought exercise as to what more can be unpacked from that universe.
Right. Yeah. Let me just clarify for listeners. The Periarchon is a work of Origen, often translated on first principles. We have it in Latin in a translation by Rufinus, which we have very strong reason to believe was edited to make it more acceptable to a Western Christian audience. We don't have the original Greek, but this letter from Justinian, that Justinian, to someone called Menas, where he's ranting about bad Christian thought, gives us some Greek.
That's right.
From this text, the Periarchon, which seems to imply, or not imply, state that humans can be transmigrated into angelic bodies, and demons can be transmigrated into human bodies, all of which backs up the general notion in antiquity that Origen is a universal salvationist, which is something he gets condemned for, but also this specific sort of Christian reincarnationism, which involves movement toward God through better and better bodies, actually, just becoming better types of entity. So that's Evagrius. Those who wish to explore Evagrius more, highly recommended that you do that. Could do no better, if they are English speakers, than to check out the volume that you co-produced with an all-star cast of other editors and translators. OUP, look in the notes to this episode. But let's turn to Justinian.